A few months ago, Mr. Haefeli mentioned that he and his wife had seen a movie that was out, and it was called Bridge of Spies. Some of you may have seen that movie, a very excellent movie. And it starred the actor Tom Hanks, and it was based on a true story that took place late in the 1950s and the early 60s here in this country. I watched the movie. I was very impressed by it for a lot of reasons, and one of the reasons was that it brought back a lot of memories for me personally, as I was only 12 years old when this was going on in 1957 and 1960 when it really escalated. The movie time period was during the Cold War between the United States, the Soviet Union, or the Soviet bloc countries, mainly Russia back then. The term Cold War is an oxymoron to me. How can you have a Cold War? How can you have a Cold War? Both the United States and Russia had the capabilities at that time to destroy each other. That was a real fear. And they could have done that, but instead the two countries feared and despised one another and spied on one another to find out what the other was doing and what their next move might be during the Cold War, which it lasted from 1945 to 1990, when the Berlin Wall finally came down. Well, the true story began in 1957 with the capture of Rudolf Abel. Rudolf Abel, a Russian spy who was living in the United States. And in order to make that sure that Abel appears to receive a fair trial once he was captured, to not appear to the Russians as using an anti-American propaganda against us, we had to figure out a clever way. They hired a Brooklyn lawyer named James Donovan, played by Tom Hanks. He specialized in insurance law, not governmental law or anything, but insurance law. You wonder, why would they pick a guy that just did insurance law? So you get the feeling right away the government wasn't going to try real hard to defend Abel by selecting an attorney who specialized in insurance law. When James Donovan was asked by his firm and his country to represent Rudolf Abel, he was hesitant. If you've seen the movie or read the history of it, he was hesitant to accept. The mood of the country back then was very fearful of the Russian government, during the Cold War period. During this time, our schools had regular air raid drills. Some of you I know will remember that, air raid drills in the school, to prepare ourselves in case the Russians were to drop a bomb on us. We would hide under our desk, which all of us did back then. We also had those monthly air raids, the first of the month, to check out, to make sure they were working. And we were instructed, many of us, to go in our homes at those times when you hear the air raids and find a safe place. And that was a time of bomb shelters being built all over the country at that time. So Jim Donovan, to accept this job, to defend a Russian spy, was about the most unpopular thing to do anyone could do at that time. And someone had to do it. Jim Donovan could have chosen simply to walk away from his duty, or he could have chosen to do the minimum possible, to help Abel. But what this story shows us is that he didn't walk away from that. He didn't just do what was required of him and leave it at that. The story is about how he went, and what I call, beyond the call of duty. Beyond the call of duty. Brethren, we are here now observing the last day of unleavened bread. During these days, we've been focusing on keeping sin out of our lives, is what it is all focused around. Keeping sin out of our lives, keeping the commandments of God is our Christian duty. to keep the commandments of God. And that's a good thing. God established those commandments for us. But Jesus Christ called us to an even higher duty than just keeping the commandments of God. He talks about that. Take your Bibles, let's turn over to the book of Matthew. He's called us to a higher duty. Matthew chapter 5, and verse 14, we'll begin reading. It says, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house." Verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And what he means by that, when he uses the word fulfill, in the Greek it means to make full, to magnify that meaning, to make it full. So Christ taught how to apply those commandments that he gave. Now, not just by the letter of the law, but now it's to the spirit of the law, the spiritual aspect of God's law. He goes on in the chapter, where I'll just paraphrase it, in verse 21, he talks about that you have heard of old that we were in danger of the judgment if we murdered someone. But he said that if you even now are angry with your brother, you shall be in danger. Christ said that the commandments tell us that we are not to commit adultery. That's what the commandments tell us, a physical act. But now he's magnified it, and he said, whoever even looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery in his heart. And as we keep these physical days here, brethren, the physical unleavening out of our lives these past 7 days, Christ also wants us to learn not just the physical acts that we do, sometimes even in keeping commandments and the physical things we do, but he wants us to learn the spiritual lessons as well. He wants us to go beyond that. He wants us to go beyond the call of duty as Christians and let our light shine, as it said, before men. And that means applying the commandments to our lives in hundreds of different scenarios and ways that you may come across and never expect it in your everyday to day life. You know, one of the lessons we can learn from that movie and from these days is do the right thing. Do the right thing. Jim Donovan didn't want to defend Rudolph Abel at first. He felt like a traitor. He was betraying his own government, he felt. Yet he still did it. It was his job given to him by the same government that Rudolph Abel was trying to spy on. One of the requirements of living God's way is to do things that we don't always like to do. But it's the right thing to do. We take sometimes the low road instead of the high road because it's easy for us. It's easier. Example that we could say was Joseph in the Bible. Joseph of Egypt. For years, he went to prison. Joseph was in prison for years because he did the right thing under the conditions that he was being accused. If he had given in to Potiphar's wife and demands, he could have remained a free man, most likely, but he didn't. He did the right thing. We all have things come up, don't we, in every day-to-day life that are unexpected. How do we react to those things? How do we react to them? Sometimes our initial reactions will be very human, very carnal in the way we react to them. But doing the right thing is usually not the easiest one, as I said, because of our human nature, and it gets in the way, doesn't it? The Apostle Paul wrestled with this. He wrestled with it. Let's take our Bibles and turn over to the book of Romans. Romans. Paul struggles here. You can tell it in the way he's written these scriptures. And I call this the tongue twister of the Bible when we read it. But Paul is sending a message as we read this, not only about himself, but about all, each and every one of us. It says in verse 14 of chapter 7, it says, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do." Has that ever happened to any of us? "If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find." We struggle sometimes. We struggle. "For the good that I will to do, I do not do, but the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find then a law," and that's the law of sin, "that evil is present with me and with the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward, but I see another law," that law of sin, fleshly, "in my members, warring against God's law in my mind, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, the mind I myself serve, the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin." Paul struggled just like all of us do. The second thing and lesson we can learn is doing the right thing isn't always popular. Doing the right thing isn't always popular to do it. During the trial of Rudolph Abel, attorney Jim Donovan was hated by the whole country, and the firm he worked for, the FBI, even his family was against him. They wanted him to quit trying to save Abel from the death penalty sentence. But he wanted to pursue what he saw as his legal duties to his client and seek all the legal remedies for him, even after receiving the threatening letters, phone calls. He continued defending his client. As Christians, doing the right thing isn't always popular. It's not popular to do the right thing in this day and time. Mark 13, don't have to turn there, you can write it down, but in Mark 13, verse 13, it says this, Christ says, "And you will be hated of all men for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved." He endures until the end. John 15, 18, we won't turn there, but I can write it down. It says, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you." Those are strong words. If you were of the world would love its own. You get that line? If you go along with the world, everything they say and do, they'll love you that much more. "Yet because you are not of the world, because I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." Those are pretty strong words. Right now in this country, our Christian lifestyle across this country is under attack like never before. We haven't changed, but the world is changing at a very quick pace, isn't it? Changing at a very quick pace. With the current issues that have been in the news lately, we're standing apart from the growing popular thinking. The popular thinking of this country, the people in this country. But you know, this is nothing new. It's not new. Even in ancient times in Babylon, there were three young men who were under attack for their beliefs. And this all happened around the year 586, before Christ. 586 it happened, before he was born. We know these men. I know you all know the story. We're going to look at it briefly here. They were Babylonian captives, and they gave them their own names. They named them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But they were formerly princes from the tribe of Judah. We know the story, how a decree went out, and that everyone, when the music was played, was to bow down to that 90-foot image. And if you did not bow down when the music was played and worship it, then you would be one of those who would be cast into a burning furnace. And it says immediately you would be cast into a burning furnace. Well, back in 586 BC, doing the right thing that day definitely wasn't popular. It wasn't a popular. But I'm sure the three young men stuck out pretty badly standing there, as they did not bow down to that image. They did not bow down to worship the image that they were told to do. Let's go back and read briefly some of this. Let's go back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 3. It wasn't very popular for them that day. Everyone else did it, but they didn't do it, and they had to take a stand. It says in verse 8 of Daniel 3, "Therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews." They're speaking of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. "And they spoke to the king Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn," so they heard the music, "you were to worship the golden image." Down in verse 12, it says, "But there are certain Jews you have set over affairs of the province." They were in positions. They had already been placed there in higher up positions. "And that was the men of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, did not pay you due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Well, Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring them before him. So they were brought before them, and Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them, and he says, "You," in verse 14, jumping into the middle of the verse there, it says, "You do not serve my gods or worship the golden image which I have set up." He's questioning them. Down in verse, latter part of verse 15, he says, "But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" And I love their reply here. "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this manner. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up.'" Well, as the story goes on, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. They heated the furnaces up so hot that the men that put them in there were actually killed. And they were put in there, and it says in verse 24 of that chapter, Nebuchadnezzar was astonished as he rose and hastened and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said, O king, true, O king, look. He answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Verse 27. And the satraps, the administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the hair on the fire had no power. Their hair of their heads was not singed, nor was their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Amazing. A miracle. We skip down to verse 29. Nebuchadnezzar has a big change of tune in his approach. He says, therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made in ashes, heaped upon into ashes. Because there is no other God who can deliver like this. That's his words, he said. Then the king promoted the three men once again in the province of Babylon. Doing the right thing isn't always popular, but it is the right thing to do. They stood and did the right thing. The third thing, don't compromise your integrity. Don't compromise your integrity, the third lesson. And the definition of integrity is the quality of being honest, having strong moral principles, moral uprightness, integrity. You know, the best compliment a Christian can receive has to do with their integrity and moral character, because this is what counts with God. It's what counts with God. Proverbs 28, verse 18 says, whoever walks in integrity will be delivered, but he who is crooked in his ways will suddenly fall. Will suddenly fall. We're going to look at an example of someone in the Bible about a servant who was a servant to a prophet of God who became crooked in his ways, who became very evil and crooked. His name was Gehazi. Gehazi. Don't hear a lot about him, but it may not be as familiar a name in the Bible. Gehazi was the personal servant to the prophet Elisha, his personal servant. So he's very close to a man of God, Elisha. We can read the account back in 2 Kings. Let's go to 2 Kings. 2 Kings here, chapter 5. And we will read about one who has integrity and one who doesn't. It says in verse 1, now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because of him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, and he was a leopard. He was a leopard. But he was high up in the army. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back captive a young woman from the land of Israel. She waited on Naomi's wife. Then she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Speaking of Elisha. And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, thus and thus, he doesn't get the story quite clear, thus and thus, said the girl who is from the land of Israel. Well, he gets his story mixed up a little bit. So the king of Syria said, go now and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed and took with him quite a bit of money here. 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, "Now be advised when this letter comes to you that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." Well, they thought they were supposed to go to the king of Israel, and that was not who she said. And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy?" He couldn't heal him of his leprosy. "Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So he sent Naaman to Elisha's house. And he goes to Elisha's house. And Elisha, of course, knew all about this, that he was coming. And Elisha didn't go out. He sent his messenger out, and the commentaries say that messenger was Gehazi, most likely, because he was his servant. It doesn't state his name there. So he sends Gehazi out to talk to him, and Elisha says, "Go down to the river and put yourself in it three times, seven times, and you will be healed." Well, Naaman became furious. He became so furious that he said he was insulted that Elisha didn't come out. Well, Elisha wanted to give God the credit for the healing. He didn't want him to be there. And he said, "I could have gone in my own rivers, in my own country, and done this." And his servant told him, in verse 13, the servant came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, if the prophet," speaking of Elisha, "had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he had a change of heart. He went down and dipped seven times into that Jordan, according to the saying of the man, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. He was healed. Verse 15, "Then he returned to the man of God," speaking of Elisha now, "and stood before him, and he said, 'Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant.'" Remember, he brought all that money, lots of money. "But," in verse 16, he said, "'As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing from you.' And he urged him to take it, but he refused." He refused. So Naaman said, "Then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offerings or sacrifices to other gods but to the Lord. Yet in this thing, may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the temple of Reuben to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Reuben. And when I bow down in the temple of Reuben, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing." Then verse 19, "Then he said to him, 'Go in peace.' So depart from him a short distance." But here's where the integrity of Gehazi, we find out what kind of person he really is. "But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, 'Look, my master has spared Naaman, this Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought." He knew he brought money. "But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." Now, Elisha didn't. "So Gehazi pursued Naaman, and when Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from his chariot to meet him and said, 'Is all well?' And he said, 'All is well. My master has sent me.'" A lie. Outright lie. "Has sent me, saying, 'Indeed, just now 2 young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them 1 talent of silver and 2 changes of garments.'" Well, it was all a lie. It was all made up right there. "So Naaman said, 'Please take 2 talents. He urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in the bags and the 2 change of garments and handed them to the 2 of the servants, and they carried them on ahead of them. And when he came to the citadel, he took them from their hand and stored them away in the house. He stored them in the house, the money. Then he let the men go, and they departed. Now, here's where it really gets good. It says, now when he went in and stood before his master, Elisha, and Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, your servant did not go anywhere. Another lie. He didn't go anywhere. Then he said to him, Elisha said, and God told him all of this and revealed it to him. He says, did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariots to meet you? And then he says, is it time to receive money, to receive clothing, olive groves, vineyards, sheep, ox, male, and female servants? It's like, when did we start doing this? When did we start taking money for what we do? And from that time forward, leprosy, the leprosy of Naaman, shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. Just as we've just read here about this, if I find my place here. Earlier in the Proverbs, I said and gave you a scripture earlier in Proverbs that said, in Proverbs 28:18, it says, whoever walks in integrity will be delivered, but he who is crooked in his ways will suddenly fall. And that's what happened to Gehazi. We read in 1 Corinthians 5:8, it says, therefore, speaking of these feast days, it says, therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Integrity. That's exactly what it is. It's integrity. The fourth lesson that we can learn is, don't grow tired of doing the right thing. You notice there's a theme in all of these. Don't grow tired of doing the right thing. Israel had many kings, and some started out great. They were close to God and did all the right things up until the end of their reign. Solomon is a good example of that type of a king. He started out humble, serving God. Let's turn over to 1 Kings real quick. 1 Kings 3. And read what Solomon himself even said. 1 Kings 3 here in verse 7. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. He was around 12, between 12 and I think he's 12 to 18 years old, but I think he's around 12 years old. I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. This is what he asked for. He says, therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. He was very pleased. In verse 12, and behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall anyone like you arise after you. So God blessed him there and gave him what he asked. But just a few chapters over, we see a drastic change in 1 Kings 11. Turn over to 1 Kings 11. Verse 4 here says in 1 Kings 11, It says, "For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David." Verse 6, "Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David." Verse 9, "So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded." What was his duty? "Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant." You can write this scripture down, but over in the book of Galatians 6, verse 8, it says, let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all." It says to all. That means your family, your extended family, your workplace, your neighbors, wherever you go. You're that light to all, and especially to those who are of the household of faith, with each and every one of us. There's a world leader today that everyone sees as an example of a ruler who does not grow weary of well-doing. Anybody know who I'm talking about? In this world, there's a leader who doesn't grow weary of well-doing. I'm speaking of the Queen Elizabeth of England. Recently in Life, Hope, and Truth, there was an article written by one of our ministers in England, Peter Hawkins. And he said this. He said, Princess Elizabeth Alexandra Mary was not expected to become Queen of England. But as she turns 90 years old, and we know that was just a week or so ago, she turned 90 years old, she has been on the throne for almost 65 years. Her loyal subjects around the world acknowledge this great-grandmother, the longest-serving monarch in the history of England, as the figurehead of a unique and special monarch. There were a couple of quotes that he quoted in the article about two quotes she had given in speeches. And I admire her tremendously for this. She says, in 2002, she said, "I know just how much I rely on my faith to guide me through good times and the bad. Each day is a new beginning. I know that the only way to live my life is to try to do what is right and to take the long view, to always be looking ahead, to give of the best in all that day brings, and to put my trust in God." You don't hear that much anymore. "I draw strength from the message of hope in the Christian Gospels." In 2014, not very long ago, she said, "For me, the life of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, is an inspiration and an anchor in my life, a role model of reconciliation and forgiveness. He stretched out his hands in love and accepted, in acceptance and healing. Christ's example has taught me to seek to respect and value all people, whatever faith or none." Pretty amazing lady. A wonderful lady. Getting back to the Cold War story that I've been talking about through here. The Cold War is a true story from the 60s. It was a good thing that Attorney James Donovan fought so hard to keep Rudolph Abel from the death sentence, which he did. He was found guilty, of course, but he did not receive the death penalty. After he was found guilty of being a Russian spy in 1957, 3 years later, because of something that happened in 1960 that many of us still remember to this day, one of our nation's pilots by the name of Gary Powers, and it was big news in where I grew up because he only lived 30 miles from my hometown in Kentucky. So it was big news around the town. A young pilot flying a U-2 jet over Russia to take spy photos was shot down by the Russians, and he was taken a prisoner. Very similar to Rudolph Abel, both spies for their countries. Once again, James Donovan was called in to negotiate, this time to negotiate an exchange of two spies. And the rest is history. Later that year, Donovan negotiated another release of 10,000 prisoners in Cuba in the failed invasion of the Bay of Pigs invasion that took place. History shows that Donovan went beyond the call of duty in the job given to him. He went beyond his call of duty. Brethren, let's take our Bibles. Let's turn over finally to Luke 17. Luke 17. Luke 17. We'll begin reading here in verse 5. And if you have the same Bible I do, there's a subtitle there. It says Faith and Duty. Faith and Duty. The Apostle Paul... I mean, not the Apostle Paul. I got Paul on my mind still. Christ said, because Christ warned him, he said, and the apostles said to the Lord, increase our faith. Wouldn't we like our faith to be increased, all of us, if we were to ask that of him? Increase our faith. So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted by the sea, and it would obey you. And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once, sit down to eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drink, and afterward you will eat and drink. It was his job as a servant. It was his duty just to do those things. It wasn't nothing special. It was just his duty. And then he says in verse 9, does he thank the servant because he did those things that were commanded of him? I think not, because it was his job. So likewise, you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. That's what we've done, what was our duty to do. Just like the story of the man who was given the one talent in Matthew 25. What did he do with that? He took and he buried it. He buried it. He didn't increase it or multiply it or anything, and it would be taken away from him. But he was an unprofitable servant, wasn't he? He was an unprofitable servant. Christ would like to see, brethren, his followers go beyond the call of duty to magnify God's laws, to magnify them, the spiritual aspect of them, and be able to say to us, brethren, one day, well done, thou good and faithful servant.